Today's talk is given by Professor Chris Peat, Chair of Design Informatics here at Edinburgh. His talk is entitled Designing with the City as a Database. Chris Peat is Chair of Design Informatics at the University of Edinburgh, where his research focuses upon the network society, digital art and technology, and the Internet of Things. Chris is co-director of the Design Informatics Research Centre, that is a home to a combination of researchers working across the fields of interaction design, temporal design, anthropology, software engineering, and cryptocurrencies, amongst many other things. Very interesting place. So this exciting range of fields and topics sounds like ideal seminar material for our ever-diverse EEO audience. And who better to guide us through these times of rapid change and rapidly developing ideas than Chris Speed?
Thank you very much. So, I'm a fine artist, don't tell anyone, but that's fine. My history, my heritage. So, as I encounter data, there's always a kind of a criticality about it. Who's it for? What's it doing? And in a sense, it's openness as well. Fine artists don't like determined readings. We don't like data to be definite. We want data, we want artifacts to be open to interpretation. So what I'm going to show you, what I'm going to trot to through today, you go through this anxiety thinking, they're not going to get this, but I have to show it to them. But they might get it, and then they'll change what I think about it. So some of these things I think you'll see are very open and very artistic and design-centered in their endeavour. But I'm hoping that I can thread a narrative together which tries to talk about where we think the city or the artifacts or everything around you might be if we consider it as data, and how that changes if we give it some level of agency or we use it in different ways. The premise for most of the research that is challenging us at the moment is that we're moving from a 20th century model of the economy that was push-orientated to one which is pull-orientated. And a simple way of thinking about it is think of Uber rather than think of regulated taxis. Think of Airbnb rather than thinking about Radisson Blue or the Hilton. And it's really what's happening is that in the push economy, most of us really haven't been in a data value constellation at all. We've been picking up cornflakes for years from the local supermarket. And if you think about a cornflake, someone, I guess, developed a cornflake, and then they made another 1,000 of them, and then they turned that into a cereal, and then someone thought, no way! Put it in boxes and replicate it, and then we end up with a cornflake, which hasn't intrinsically changed. Maybe the sugar content's gone up and down with trends, but actually hasn't intrinsically changed for 100 years. And it's pushed to supermarkets, and you go and collect it. Now, many of the products in the room still come to you, or you go to them because they're push. Some of them cheekily even have a little message on the side of them saying, throw them away in a bin, as though you take full responsibility of where they go next in the world. You know, kind of releasing the producer and the manufacturer of any responsibility whatsoever. And that push is very much connected to value chains. Chain of production, in which in the end it's you buy a peak price. I don't know what the little French beers are worth. They're cheap. They were even cheaper to make in order for you to buy them. So peak production, peak point, and then they don't care. All right. So I'm very interested in that move and how particularly data offers a feedback loop to then offer essentially pull economies. But when we look at pull economies and the rise of them, of course, we are the pull economy, and we are seen as brokers, as prosumers in any of this economy now. But we don't do what these people do. If I've got Weetabix or cornflakes, I'll give it to you. I don't really need it back. I don't really need you to pay for it either. So we're beginning to operate in very complicated ways, ways which aren't consistent with the 20th century push economy. And that's quite an important context for our research, because it means it has very disruptive characteristics, it has very exciting characteristics with new technology, but not wanting to get on the bandwagon of the new technology, how do you explore the tensions between this practice and those established practices? And to say that the value chain for designers, people like me, the community I work with, it's been pretty tricky. Our research, I think, has been very poor in the last 20 years, because the push economy has hired and fired designers around this area, and we haven't really been involved in the supporting or the data network over here. Suddenly, for the first time, designers and interaction designers are starting to mediate value in what's described as a value constellation. So a value constellation, and these are where I'm interdisciplinary, when you think, what's your takeaway from the speed talk? Artist, designer, what's the takeaway? This is a value constellation, and it might be a value constellation of Google. But there's you, and you fire up your Google browser, and you're looking for a hat, as you do. And then you find a hat firm in there, and that's the Google frame. And maybe Google are offering it. To get into that frame, and to be connected, you're in amongst of a whole bunch of problematics. I mean, algorithms, how are you going to get to the top of that ranking? Reputations, if people didn't buy your hat, or they didn't like your hat, you'll fall out of those reputations. So understanding that value constellation is a different way that contemporary organisations are having to negotiate where their value is and how they sustain it. The question for you might be, and I'll come right back at the right at the end and show you this, what is the value constellation then for your material? If it's a map, an old paper map, what is the value constellation? Because they don't change so often. But my Google map and my Apple map on my iPhone, both are changing an awful lot of the time because the value constellation is being constantly tweaked to guarantee a value proposition. And I keep using both applications. I don't know what you do, but sometimes both map apps offer me different value for certain things. So that's the core of what we're talking about. What I want to go first is a little bit kind of, if you give me the conceit, I want to go on a small humanity story here. I'm particularly interested at the moment in how we move from the city as a database, which might have been seen as a cold database. And by cold, I mean a GIS database, which is terrifically deep, terrifically full of coordinates, spatial, social, whatever your GIS database are, and how they then move into an open platform, and that all of those coordinates, that data, that material, then it enters a market. Because much of your data, my hunch is, some of the databases I have for my my GPS applications is just on our little server, and we don't. It's protected, it has some personal data in it, so we just see it. What happens when that moves into a value constellation then? What happens when Foursquare start passing their data on to Apple? What happens when that bleeds out? Because suddenly all of your data enters a marketplace. And what happens when that data then reconstitutes in the context of a map for different types of people? And of course, that's one way I like to think for communities, particularly the humanities. We know that we've had pots of data, databases, and Hagerstrand's models were a really interesting kind of precursor to thinking about what happens when this data gets shared, explored. What type of market is that making? I mean, I don't like the word market, but what type of interactions and values are being contested in these spaces? Now, an area that particularly is at the moment is the blockchain. So this isn't live, this is a screenshot. It's actually about a year old, so we're already at 360,000 blocks. But the blockchain is the underlying platform of the digital currency Bitcoin. What you're seeing here is that in every transaction, which is open, they're sealed transactions, I can't see, they're all encrypted, I begin to jump around. Let's see, I'll just go back to this. So these are all transactions. So imagine all of your GIS coordinates, all of them, and you manage to see what people were doing as they exchanged those transactions. How might that be look? And if you can jump on a transaction, I can actually see the IP address of where it's located where that transaction took place. So these are, the blockchain's becoming interesting because it talks about not just the database as something that is centralized within a certain service and maybe secure. It's beginning to talk about what happens when it becomes distributed to enable different people to share, exchange, build their own value frameworks because it's essentially a document of transactions. What would it be like for all your databases to be conceived not as a storage, but actually as a ledger of transactions? How would that change the map? What would you take out? What would people be using it for through that transaction in order to build different perspectives? Now, one way I like to take this through is beginning to think about, well, I think what worked for me was looking at a movie. Now, Darden Brothers, has anyone seen this? It's really good. Go and watch it. I'm going to try and motivate you to watch it. But I want you to see this as GIS, as geographic data and transactions. So I don't know what you do. I know a couple of what you do. And I'll report you soon. But when I need you to do something for me, which is a little bit speculative, which is the metaphor here is that Sandra has just been told she's lost a job on a Friday about now, 4:45, and that's the boss and have to drive home. And what's happened is the boss pulled a cheeky stunt. He's got to make some savings in his solar panel company. And there's 17 people in the company, or there was 5 minutes ago. They can't afford that 17th. It's a bit precarious. So what he said to everyone half an hour ago is, hey, Sandra's been off with depression. Do you want to keep Sandra, or do you want €1,000? So 16 of the other staff have said, do you want to take a €1,000 bonus, or would you prefer to keep Sandra? And 5 minutes ago, they voted, I'll let her go. I'll have €1,000. So, what happens next over the movie then? She's got 2 days and 1 night, to begin to start convincing everybody by lobbying them, by going to every single house. Now, in these cutscenes, what you'll find is that she goes to houses and she begins to look at the transaction. So what's happening here, this is a value conversation. Every time she meets someone, and you get some clues, I'm trying to keep some clues in here, about the financial disposition, the context in which these are in. And when we see her with bottled water, and some people we see clearly not with bottled water. We see conditions in which some people feel terrible about voting against her. So we see all of this in this really interesting movie, a ledger, a cognitive ledger, I'm trying to call it. Because what's happening is all of you in the movie, and as I sit there with my partner and friends, is I begin to make judgments about what I value. And in the end, that the suspense is, I mean, you see her in an artisan bakery. And then you see other people really divided about trying to, they're holding down two jobs, half the family are out of work, the kids look like they're running up downstairs, very complicated spaces. Now all of these end up in some violent flare points, some contested ideas about, well, look, you don't know what my life is like. And all the time we're seeing these transactions. So in some ways, if you could imagine what your data is doing then, as soon as your data becomes open, as soon as you begin to put it out into a different space, you're beginning to establish the opportunity for other members of your community, your audiences, to build a transaction. And what you think your value, your data is valuable for, I guarantee, isn't what someone else will draw from it. In the end, we end up back into the work on Monday morning, and there's a ballot, and we have an outcome, for better or worse. It's very simple. When you do it with students, you do it with people. People side, and they make entirely different decisions, rather like deciding whether we should go to war or not. You find a whole bunch of things, all based on data, decision-making. Now, it's useful for me because I think in the blockchain, as you see in blockchain, what you're beginning to do is we after the internet, and we know what's happened to the internet, didn't we? Those great dreams we had have just turned into 5 stacks. Remember the internet? It wasn't. It was now one of the 5 stacks of the Google stack. That's the internet for many people. If you ask, hey, can I get online? If you don't see the word Google, you don't believe you're searching the internet. That is the internet for many people. There's Facebook, another stack. Apple has stacks, of course, connected to hardware. I think, I'm going to get the others. Amazon is a shopping stack. And the fifth is contested, probably, whether it's Microsoft have that stack. It's probably to do with the operating systems still, but whether it's other people are moving into that space. So those are the stacks. Now, they're marketplaces, but they're managed marketplaces. GIS, what is your market then? What happens when you take something like the blockchain, I'm not sure I explained it very well, but you begin to start understanding data is at the centre of a transaction? What types of spaces does it produce? What new types of maps does it produce? Anything you think it does, I guarantee it'll be contested by someone else. So what I did in there is plot drum. So that's kind of what's excited me recently about where we thought about the internet and data as one thing. We're beginning to realise that value and values are different, and that we will have different values. We can have family values, but I bet my family does different things to you, and it has different things in its fridges. So what happens when data is in that space? So what I'm going to do is I introduce three ways that we then have to negotiate data. So myself and John Overlander have developed this ablative model, which looks at designing from data, when on occasion the transaction is to take illicit information and knowledge and wisdom out of data. Sometimes that's out in the field, and I'll bring it back to the studio. What we do when we design with data, which is where we deal with live streams, and the streams have a performativity which challenges our design decisions, and then by data, when we let data do the design for us. And what happens when humans relinquish control because algorithms begin to open up new spaces? Are there any, I presume, some data is producing its own apps now? You're the expert, I guess. Databases are producing apps without humans. So what happened in that term, and how more likely is that going to happen? Because I suspect that's already happening in some spaces. So one of the projects we pursued with Laurier over there was working with Oxfam. And this is very much understanding how we design from data. Oxfam have a particular problem. The last 6, 7, 10 years, the economic downturn has really forced this thing, this Oxfam shop, which has been around for 80 years, 90 years, into a complicated condition in which you and I have started to do things which aren't cricket. One of those things is haggling. It isn't cricket, or it wasn't cricket, in a push economy to expect to haggle over goods in an Oxfam shop. Why would you do that? Because the Oxfam shop is there not really as a clothes shop, it's there as an interface to trade toward eliciting value from you to help aid programs around the world. But that's not really what we worry about when times are hard. It's a clothes shop, it's a resort shop, and I want to bargain out of that. So we've been looking at how to help Oxfam. They were finding that people have started to showroom. Showroom is when all of you, this Christmas, will go into Waterstones and you'll pick up a book, you'll find a book. Oh, it weighs a bit much. I'll look at it on Amazon. Oh, I can get it even cheaper. I'll tell you what, I'll buy a coffee in Waterstones, and put the book back and order it on Amazon. You do it all the time. I'm being provocative, but I think many of us do it. And people have started to buy Oxfam shops. So they're starting to look at the CDs, find out what you can get, and then they go up to the volunteers, and say, hey, can I get that even cheaper? So there's a whole load of values which are now disconnected, of which then we begin to start arguing around over the value of things. Eric did some great work looking at how this particular types of people really haggle and change value by telling you stories about things. He shifts everything, this guy. This Columbia Road in London, this guy will shift all of those flowers because he can tell you different stories which are informed through data about where they will, what they're good for now. He can move anything because he tells you and he provides and he adds value to every single one of those flowers to allow you to negotiate. So very interesting perspectives in terms of how you do add value and you can take away value. You can add value from the past, and you can add value from the future. This is the Haggletron. So Eric and the team and I, consisting of designer and anthropologist. It's a kettle. Of course it is. It's actually a technology probe that allows us to elicit understandings about the data and the community we're working with. So a technology probe in this instance is a kettle that sits on a shelf. And in it is a webcam, and the webcam spies people, and it whistles. There is a one, and it whistles, and it tries to attract people's attention. It says, hey, I see your... So what's happening here is this woman has found something. You can see the coat hanger there, something, and she's held it up previously, which I've just edited out. And she's a kettle, which she might think is a sentient kettle. That's the Wizard of Oz moment here. We've actually got an anthropologist stuck in a cupboard in the back who's looking through the webcam. and he's talking to her. And the captain is trying to negotiate, change the value by adding forms of data. And sometimes she's adding it from the past. She's saying, hey, did you know that a local school teacher wore that and she's been working in the community for 20 years? And suddenly you build a picture and it changes the value of the object from the past. Other times, Siobhan will throw it into the future and say, but did you know, if you give me 50p more, it just might help with our project with wells and water out in Ghana. So all the time, that interface is challenging the value of that opportunity. And if they get it right, Oxfam are quite impressed in terms of this is how we might begin to enter haggling, or we might begin to help us recover the breakdown which has occurred in the last few years, where people don't know what Oxfam is good for. The CEO was talking recently, the CTO, the technical officer, saying, was given the BlackBerry of the CEO to hold on to a week for a weekend. And the CEO said to the CTO, look, we've got two Oxfam employees out in Africa at the moment, and there's a hostage situation in areas, and we're really worried we're going to lose these two Oxfam workers. So this BlackBerry, I forget his name, Simon, if it goes, you've got to pick it up. So the CTO goes to a barbecue that weekend and spends the weekend holding this damn BlackBerry. It's not his, but it might go off. It's like a small, whoa, wake-up call. And one of his niece comes on and says, but what's the deal? Just enjoy it. What's the deal with the BlackBerry? What's the phone doing all the time? And he says, well, look, you know, we've got people working in Africa. It's, you know, it might go off, and it's a real issue if it goes off. And the daughter says, really, you have Oxfam shops out there? As though the only thing that Oxfam does is sell things. So what we're trying to do particularly is how do you take data and information and join up those stories to understand how you build another way to develop value and connect it to values. That makes sense. So that's a context in which we as a team understand data from a scenario, a setting, and use tactics, technology probes to elicit that, to inform what goes back on in the studio, if that makes sense. And that's designing from data. My hunch is that many people, anthropologists, design from data. Many designers still design from. They go to a setting, do some qualitative analysis, qualitative research, and then come back. But the setting, what does it do? It just stops. It paralyzes. The architects are terrible at this. They just think the setting just freezes. And we have a problem with that because we know that the setting is evolving all the time. So the second stage then is designing with data. When systems are designed by people, when they take account the flows of data through systems, so there's a sense of the flow, the data is actually animated, it has a performativity, it has a dialogue with us. The example for this, I think, which speaks quite well, is thinking about how the Internet of Things is going to start changing some of your data. Whether you see your GIS within the Internet of Things is an interesting question. I presume it is, because I can associate a whole load of bunch of value transactions by knowing where things are. Therefore, they must be, GIS must be in the Internet of Things. The classic Internet of Things, of course, are eye kettles and fridges. What's interesting about the future of the Internet of Things is knowing where things are. And we're interested as designers because it isn't just about the energy use of the kettle, but it's actually what we do with kettles. We talk about this as a value constellation. Oh, no, sorry, it's an archetype. Making tea is an archetype. You will do it, and my hunch is we do it in similar ways with similar products. If they get very clever, of course, Google can watch your energy use and find out that the fridge gets turned on, because it's, I don't know how many watts, that gets turned on at 3 kilowatts, and actually quite quickly, through machine learning, establish that Chris is making tea. They could probably figure out that his partner, who doesn't have milk in his tea, but that's Steph having tea. So they can very quickly correlate data sets, as I say, because they're involved in transactions, to begin to understand what we're doing. And either that's a market opportunity, to then someone comes dashing round with biscuits, tea, or comes in on a drone, of course, that's the answer. Or it's worrying for me because I don't know what I'm getting. Or more likely, they deliver me something that I don't want. Like most Amazon recommendations. So we were in this project, and the project set about wiring up our house, particularly to look at how viable it is to set up these constellations, these markets. Can you turn my house into a domestic market.
So they bought, this is Horizon down in Nottingham, they bought a bunch of sensors. This is James in my cupboard, adding an electrical collar to my electrical supply so he can look for the spikes when I've got my iPhone plugged in, as tiny as that, or my kettle goes off. Humidity, and there's light sensors, a little 3D printed but with electronics talking to a Raspberry Pi. Humidity, light, and temperature thermometers. And then the bathroom, PIR sensors to see when I'm entering the bathroom. This was strange because my daughter saw it, and the toilet's there where you're at. And she says, oh, can it see me while I'm on the toilet, Daddy? Yeah, can it's an optical device. But I have to then explain how good its vision is. It's terrible, Mary. Its vision is awful. There's a plant here. If the plant moves, it will go off. So it can't, it doesn't know it's you, Mary. By then, she was quite relaxed. But quite interesting from a 9-year-old to say, hang on, what's going on in this space? So the project was already proving disruptive. And then it all streams back to a Raspberry Pi and it goes to a walled garden in a server down in Warwick. And that then became the platform for looking at data. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is a dinner party. The humidity will peak, and all the variables just happen to peak the humidity. The whole bunch, there's temperature, sorry, there's a peak. And maybe at that point, as far as the marketing community and the project were interested, that's the point when a Haagen-Dazs should have come in on the drone. Now that's what the Internet of Things can do, whether it's good or right. And what they're doing is looking for horizontals. Remember the push and the push for the verticals. So the push economy wants to get things to the supermarket, and it doesn't know. It has no idea that I put milk with my tea. I mean, it has a good guess, but they're miles apart in the supermarket. In this context, if your house becomes a market, they can look for horizontals and offer you value. Other things in the house that were capturing things, and this is where we got interested, and the marketeers have found their economy, they've found their market. But as designers, we wanted to look at the disruptions, though. Because I was getting concerned about my daughter, who's clearly got body awareness sense now, and I'm thinking, whoa, hang on, this stuff is going to get a bit more fragile as the transactions of data get more contested. So I've got some within scales. If I stay, now I jump on, myself and my partner aren't too far apart in weight, so I jump on and it says, stand on the left foot if that's you, Chris. I stand on my left foot. If that's you, Steph, would you stand on your right foot? Chris on his left. And most of the time I stay on my left foot. But every so often, why not? It's good fun. It's what marriage is about. So I stand on the right. But these are the things that we begin to do. We soil data all the time. So we have this sense back. Steph's just like, whoa, I'm fluctuating all over the place. And then I'm looking at, well, who's coming in? As Chris has come in, Steph, Mary, the two kids. And we've got, I thought I was gaming the system. Someone else has come in. So my bathroom has stood on my scales. And I see them. And I've got two cats. I don't think it's that, as cats aren't that big. So my hunch is that Mary had a sleepover, and one of her friends stood on the scales. So these are very, I think these things are so for us very, very interesting, because in those transactions, it's not going to be easy for Google to sort out this level of noise. Me jumping and messing up my partner's sense of mass, body mass and weight, or whether I'm dealing with people walking into private spaces and interrupting my data sets. You will have the same issues in yours. As a matter of course, you must do, because we're all smelly, sticky humans. What we started then was really explore these questions of privacy. So we started to wonder at what's going on behind that door. Now, I've had the two kids that are 9 and 12 now, and I haven't had a change in nappy. I don't know when they wee and poo. Do you know who knows when you wee and poo? I don't think you do. I think you like to think that when you go into those toilets, those private spaces, that you just do it on your own, and that no one writes it down. People are writing it down now. People know when you go into some of these spaces, and they want to know that because some of the transactions and some of the opportunities to market that data. So we wanted to exploit that as a breach, really, an exploration. So we developed the first Internet of Things toilet roll holder. Because you do, you want to find out the implication of this. And this is the type of data it needs back. I can show you live. I can get into my iPhone. If you're clever, you could do some quick machine learning and you can identify where the peaks and the troughs are. So this is a full toilet roll, and this is an empty roll. And as the distance between the back plate and the toilet roll shrinks, you start seeing big drops in data. You can imagine what the big drops in data are, where a lot of toilet roll is used. I'll help you out then. This is where we begin to see. Now, this is a complicated market now. It wasn't just a market where Andrex might be interested from a push perspective. Because Andrex don't know what we do with toilet roll. They haven't had it for years. We just buy it. But what if they do want to diversify into cleaning up cat stuff? Cats kill a lot of things. They're best with bells and whistles and things. But they still have to mop up the guts. So should Andrex move into the cleaning up the cat market? How do they do that? Is that a business opportunity? But what do I want to do? Do I want to let that data out? How do I negotiate a value constellation if I start giving this data, selling this data? And what do I get for it? So these are those questions which increasingly I suspect you're having to negotiate. You're beginning to broker in various contracts with external and internal parties. The new liberal model of universities and data will be, what data can you sell? What case can you trade? The open data market would say, just give it all away free. And then some third party will take it anyway. So how do you deal with those transactions? So the last area I wanted to show you is the design by data, which is quite speculative now. This is where it needs a few leaps of imagination. It's been suggested that by 2017, this is a Gartner report, a significant disruptive digital business will be launched that was conceived by a computer algorithm. Now, we thought Uber was pretty interesting and radical and disruptive, but it was developed by a human. We thought Airbnb was pretty interesting. It wasn't the normal type of way to develop the biggest hotel chain on the planet. But what is going to come in 2017 will be more than human. Yes, okay, humans set up the algorithms in the first place to launch this thing. But don't worry about the invasions of extraterrestrials. The extraterrestrial phenomenon of 2017, the data sets that you've got and people who run algorithms through them, will offer things that we couldn't have seen as anthropocentric designers of services. Some of them might not got taken up. Some of them might be just batshit crazy. Some might be really dangerous. But whatever happens, things are going to start writing things. So we're interested in what these things might be. So I've got a couple of examples to speculate. And they're by no means, well, of course they're human speculations. So already they feel flawed, in that respect. But this is, so you're probably aware of things like this. This was an advert developed by an advertising agency back in 2009. It's called Sixth Sense. And while she's on the phone, of course, and of course it's an advertising agency in Soho developed an advert for Vodafone to sell phones. But really, what she's really selling, they're selling, is a sixth sense. If you stay connected all of the time, we will predict your futures. I'll do it again. This is Google Now. This is predictive algorithms. This is predictive ways of beginning to think about, we know so much about you, if you stay connected, you never leave your ear. We will begin to help you navigate what's around the corner in life, relationships, crime. If you deconstruct it, the potentials, and then all these push, you see these push problems coming through. If you look at the coding, it suggests there's a whole new market in which data connections will challenge entirely what you know to be the present and what might be coming around the corner. So interested in that, we worked on a large EPSRC grant called Sixth Sense Transport. What might it be like to anticipate GIS or social databases that could anticipate things around the corner? What might that be like? And we looked at stories such as this one. The Smith family are on the way to the beach, but the daughter is fed up. So then they send some of the data out to a community, and the community come out of the blue and pick them up in a taxi. Because we're beginning to be interconnected in a social manner with GIS to allow these people to build connections. I'll go and pick them up. So actually, it's beginning to be a type of, again, a pull economy. On this one, I won't go so fast on this one. This one, the family forgot their beer. So what they're able to do is throw a geofence onto Asda nearby. And anybody else with that application, so they then walk into Asda, then gets a request that says, ooh, could you pick up some beer for us? And this chap then goes off and gets the beer and brings it back. So we're trying to look at the social networking for transactions across GIS databases. So we started to play around with this, and we built a very simple app presented at the RGS conference a couple of years back. And what you're seeing here is a shared application. There's a whole bunch of people in this network. I can't see the people, because what we wanted to talk about is what it might be like then, not for the people to mediate actions, but for objects. So that's not three people carrying a beach ball. That's a beach ball telling three people where to take it in the network. So what happens is, as people move through the network, what's happening? They're polling, saying, I'd like a beach ball, please. And then when you submit something, you also get an offer back saying, OK, you can have your beach ball if you go and pick up a tennis ball. And you walk the tennis ball somewhere, and the tennis ball tells you where it needs to go. So people end up with the most extraordinary arrivals, because they didn't book you to get them the thing. It happened in through 2 degrees of separation. And it makes sense. I'll show you this one. This is easy to understand. We ran this in a workshop in Manchester where we were very interested in how an object could get from this part of Manchester to this part of Manchester by using a crowd source, really. So the assumption here is that it wants to get over there. There's lots of people in Manchester running our application. Well, at least there's 15, 12 people running the application. All we do is we poll the direction, the bearing, and the speed of all of those people. And what happens is, when somebody picks up a teddy bear, and as they move along, actually the teddy bear can make its way all the way across town by just piggybacking the trajectories and the routines of people. So the algorithm itself, to some extent, becomes a little bit like an agent. You don't know where you're going to go, you don't know what you're going to receive, but if you're up for it in the street, people might give you something that you don't want. In fact, the person you give it to doesn't want. But in the end, it gets to the person at the end of the relationship. So you get that moment of uncertainty that the algorithm is steering things through space. That's a screenshot of the app, and you start seeing those bearings. And when you get a moment, get close within a small geofence, which is a human, of course, it alerts you, and then you trade, you take the object. And these are the things that you can offer to move around. So suddenly in Manchester we started seeing strange objects moving through the streets, which the objects knew where they wanted to go, but the people didn't. And there was a lovely moment in the workshop when people came back and said that they talked about a high street, or they saw the high street in a completely different way. Rather, people with projects and routines and no need to interact with anybody else. Actually, suddenly, they went round every corner, looking at everybody, thinking, are you the agent for change? Are you the person I trade with? And it changed people's, they were very optimistic and very happy, and they just didn't know who was going to come around the corner to receive this strange blue balloon thing. But it was an incredibly affective approach to thinking how transactions, if you hand them over to an algorithm, that are moving GIS data, begin to move around. So that quote comes back, and the last project I'll mention then is where we also want to start doing with things. There's an idea that you are, you're pretty good at using things according to their determination, but you do funny things. So whenever you buy stuff, when it isn't designed for being for sticking under a door, but when we do push things out to you, because we don't know what you do with them. You do wrong things with them. But it's fine, because you get by, you may do. The Think Tank project wants to know what you do wrong, and then feed that back to manufacturers to start saying, hey, Wellington Boots manufacturers, did you know you're a really good doorstop? How would that reflect the business? Does that mean we don't need as many doorstops? Because we've actually all got doorstops in our houses. It's just that only a few of us have learned that they're really good at sticking under certain doors. So this again, it needs an instance in which we don't worry about the solo designer. And you have grown up in an area where the solo designer has destroyed my industry, because we think Johnny Ive is some type of god. And he's not. He's a guy working in a collaborative context. We think Philip Stark is an idiot. But we put these designers on kind of pinnacles. We've more recently moved to accepting that we all co-design. We're all designers. We all have imaginations, we have fears, we have ways of moving through things. But very, I don't think what we realise is that while there's a lot of you in the room, there's a lot more things in the room. So how might we, as a paradigm shift, start releasing this idea that everything in the room, every person in the room is a good designer? What might it be like to design with all of the things? Because all of those chairs have had people in them. All of those chairs know how people have used them in different ways. How might the blinds be? The blinds probably know better than anybody how to deal with light and temperature in this room, to some extent. They probably need a connection with people in that community there. But how might we give things a chance to speak for themselves and design? And it's worrying for the designers, but we quite like it. So this is an instance with Quirky, quirky.com. They have a crowdsource method to designing things. And they have 854 people working together to come up with this thing, this proposition, this value proposition. Which is good, 854 people, that's more I'd get in my house or my design studio. But how many plugs and sockets are there in Europe? If I didn't ask 800 people, if I were able to interrogate, I don't know, the 40 million four-ways in Europe and find out how people use them and why some people put umbrellas under them to prop them up, how, what might all of the four-ways say about the health, the safety, the opportunity, the length of the cord in terms of use? How would we elicit that from data? Which, again, designers designed the four-ways, humans did, but we don't really understand what happens when it leaves the push economy and you start doing funny things with them at home. What might it be like? So, in a crude sense, there's an idea that if this thing comes into your house tonight, it has no idea what it is. It hasn't a face. It just doesn't know. It's just been born. And it comes into your house. And it goes into a very dark place. Straight away, it goes into a very dark place. Every day, though, it keeps coming out. And it comes around in the evening. And it has a very curvaceous friend. And it has quite a pointy friend. And they seem to hang around a lot for some period of the day. And then it goes back and meets more of its kind. Very strange. But they do have a shower. They all have a big group shower. And it's fantastic. And after about 3 weeks, it says, hey, wow, I think I'm a fork and I think I know what I do. Now, the thing is, in this family, though, there's one person in this family who just doesn't keep it as a fork identity. Every so often, someone uses it to open paint. Now, our hunches, most machine learning will identify the forkness. But if you could begin to look anomalies in all of your data sets, so where are your data sets telling the truths and the patterns are consistent, what happens is every so often it gets confused and it thinks it's a screwdriver. Rather like the boot. I'm a Wellington boot, I'm good for the rain, I'm a doorstop. How do you gather that data? Because that's the stuff which, if we're not careful in data science, we pattern out all of the humanity or the anomalies which describe some of the things that we do at the other end of the push market. All those things in your constellations, all of where your maps are being used wrong. Because it might be that in that stuff we find out how to organise different data sets. So we've been doing some studies, we've been doing things wrong for a bit really. We have these autographers which are data capture, they're like cameras and they sit here, they take a picture every 20 seconds. They're great for anthropology, ethnographic studies. But we've started to put them, assuming that the things count, we've started to put them on the things, not just the humans. So in this little archetype here of making tea, we put one on the fridge and let the fridge tell its own story about its use. We put one on the kettle, we put one on the cup, and we thought we'd give one to the human, because it levels the playing field. And then by doing this, what we began to see is a whole bunch of different practices. So we began to see that in this particular family, there's a cup. Now, I don't know about you, but I have a favourite cup at home. But it turns out in this family that both of the humans have this love of this cup. Turns out they have the love of the same cup. And this cup is now in a love triangle because the other person doesn't know that their favourite cup is that cup. It's never around, but it's the favourite cup. And this one cup gets used and used and used by both parties as much as possible, but they just never thought about it. So with watching data and also watching youth activity by instrumenting a couple of these things, we're just beginning to understand how we might develop a design practice where we understand what things might be doing as we look for the anomalies in the machine learning and then informing the ethnography. And we're trying to build a research practice, a methodology that tries to cycle, but isn't human-centred all of the time. It tries also to allow us to see different things in our databases, our data sets, in which case we can try to design by the data, because the data has its own story to tell. Just to finish, then, this is what we think we might be able to help solve. This is you and I, Grandad. And I'll just skip through the video, really. What's happening here is he's been caught in a very complex value constellation where his daughter is brought to an Internet of Things fork to monitor his health. He wants to keep the values really consistent. He doesn't want his daughter thinking he's off diet. But he will keep the values consistent, and he, by distorting the value. Now that is what will happen with all of the devices, all the maps and the data you have. And how, it's not a case of mitigating against it, but it's about working with people, because he knows what he wants. He knows the value of the fish and chips, and we have to try and reconcile that. In another instance, his son has decided that he should get 8 hours of sleep a night. Meanwhile, Grandad wants to watch Breaking Bad in one go. He's retired. He can do it all through the night. So his Internet of Things mattress, which is counting how much sleep he gets, is gained again. And Grandad doesn't want to complicate things. He wants to keep the value constellation intact. He wants his daughter and the data to come back to make sure that they are happy and he's happy. So how do you... to summarise it. That's an additive framework. We're beginning to understand that data isn't that one thing that maybe STEM owns, or isn't that one thing that social science owns. It's a number of things. And as designers, we're having to negotiate and learn how best to qualify when it has a performative, an agency, in which it wants to move into changing its value in the market. And at other times, it just wants to tell a story, or we want to find out the story from our perspective. So the last slide is back to you then. What do you do with what is your value constellations? Your value chains have been disrupted because Google and TomTom have disavowed some of your information in your vocabulary, your lexicon. You know that Ordnance Survey had to deal with a shift in market which wasn't institutionally funded and systematic. You know that whatever you produce is entering some value constellation, otherwise you're probably not funded. Now, the constellation might be students and university. It might be a researcher and external organisation. But what happens here? Who's pushing and pulling? Who wants that data in and out? How does it build? And really, what are those new manifestations for your field? Are they maps? How do we understand them as maps? Do I see them as a map? What happens? Well, I assume all of these people are researchers like you, but actually, one of them is an algorithm. And it's threatening to pull the value constellation over to there, the value proposition over there, because the machine algorithm is learning even faster. How are you going to deal with that? Because chances are, if you don't come up with some maps to build about sustain the value proposition, the algorithm will. Thanks very much.
Thank you. You're running away. No, don't run away. Questions? We need to formulate them first. Let's take it.
I wonder if you've seen the website Lifehacker, where everyday people come up with solutions to...
Right. I want to make students interested, but I need to catch up.
It's rather interesting. My favourite is using all blue rolls to store cables.
Oh, yeah,
really? So on.
Yeah, particularly in those. I think after that push, we're all doing. Some of it's deviant. Some of it's positive. Most of it's positive deviance. You're all right. But some of it is deviant, and trying to sort out that stuff in data sets. Healthcare is going to be fascinating. how people take pills, when they take pills, what they do. I mean, what we do with medicines is really strange. I've got some medicines which are totally out of date in my cabinet. My head cheese that you do. What you do with your money, work at the Royal Bank of Scotland, the permissions that you give to your partners and friends to spend and touch and tap, really getting wild. If you're old, and my grandma would give me £10 as a 12-year-old to go to the shop and get her some fats. I'm not sure I'm allowed to do that anymore, but I remember the permissions. Now get something for yourself. The biggest fraud in banking is this micro fraud, where someone just takes a little bit. When you give them your PIN number, they'll just get a packet of crisps for themselves. So I think all of those positive deviances and then those deviances are really interesting for data science and for ourselves, because we might learn things in that as well, especially given the cuts. A lot of people have to get by and make do and get by with a whole bunch of tactics. Very creative ones. Sorry, Ran. Good, I'm glad we agree.
Maybe I'll actually ask a proper question. What's the incentive in the device where you've transported a good through a network of people for the person, say, in the middle, who doesn't necessarily know where he's going, why he's going there, apart from the obvious excitement? Have you an idea of great market value?
Yes. So there's a couple of values. I'm off the hook now. So there's a couple of interesting ideas. That one is it's carbon free. When I come out of Haymarket every morning, there's a lot of people moving across the city, and to have throw delivery systems in trucks in the system, it gets complicated. Surely doing a fireman's bucket model with a little bit of intelligence would alleviate traffic and transport. So you could migrate that onto car sharing or models as such. The incentive then would be to reduce traffic. But Waze, you know, Waze is doing a little bit like that. That I drive, if I put my Waze app on, it sends the speed that my car is going so that other people get an idea of the speed of the city. In this case, I think I'm still autonomous, so passing it after the algorithm to make some of those. What we found in the transport project on the campsite, Cartoon, was that everyone was really keen to use the app. Everyone said, hey, yeah, I'll use that, because I'll always help people. And everyone signed up for this to help. I'll get your beer, I'll pick your car, I'll pick you up at your doorstep from the beach. I mean, everyone signed up. No one asked for help, except for two Dutch campers who gamed all of the English. And the entire had the English running around. And the learning was that you and I won't ask for help anymore. Scots are pretty tough on it as well. So if you won't ask for help, maybe we wondered whether the object could do the asking. Because the chances are you'll just sit in those chairs without asking the chair if you've got permission. So you'll sit down before considering. And many of you, our assumption was that if the object does the answering, ask the question for help, then it might be that you'll respond to that because you see no threat or indebtedness. And that might be the way through. So it was part of the bigger question around. I think the convivial moment in the street was quite a nice idea. People didn't see people as threats. They saw them as opportunities to help, as though the object was doing that. Well, I'm just, you have this, and it's part of the party. Yes?
You didn't have a problem with the sort of bystander effect,
The
bystander effect, you didn't have a problem with that?
No, there was people, people seemed to be scouting. So they had said their bodies had already changed. They were looking on an app here, and it goes blue, and it says someone, so they're doing it. So they seemed to get over that. What they found is they tend to do this a little bit. But then the other person who was carrying the gift had this bloody great balloon on it. So within a moment, you'd say, hey! There were a few wrong transactions, though. A few people in the street, if you go around smiling, people smile back. So there were a few. But they seemed to think that was quite... They quite enjoyed that. Oh, yeah, a few misses, but... We worked it out. But the learning was that it's a break-in habit, it's a break-in practice of the street, which could be an extraordinary social network material. But how we break through the high street hasn't changed. People essentially will shop in the same way. They'll do the app and stuff, but we'll still do that shopping thing, even though we probably want similar things that we won't. Groupon kind of works, but it's a threat to small businesses, not just big businesses don't use it. So, what do we do in the street with the kind of the opportunity? No, we just did it. I think there are huge barriers with it in practice. The first thing is you've got to flood the market with your app, the algorithm, to get some decent. It worked with 15 people, but then a few transactions were missed. And we also had to give people a sheet of paper which gave them a routine rather than just letting them go. So the algorithm could spot them, but it's limited. So there are some scaling up is really hard with some of this speculative design stuff. Scaling up haglotrons, kettles, all over Oxfam isn't feasible either. Again, you can see what we see as barriers to social practice. And what's keeping it down, folks? Most of it is us. We don't want to do things in public which are problematic.
I was just thinking about your application and getting people to communicate with each other. And sometimes I spend some time in a very small community in North Scotland. First of all, when you walk down the street, you expect to know who everybody is. And when you meet people in the shop, if you're on their own, they'll take something home for you or they will do something for you. So are you kind of creating mini villages?
Lovely expression. Yeah, I mean, it'd be really interesting after not in my backyard markets, economies. I mean, think what neoliberalism has done to villages or towns or suburbia. Recovering some of those values would be, yeah, absolutely. It's very well expressed in that respect, though. And whether those horizontals, because that's what the street was when I was a kid. The street was a horizontal, and I could go into someone's house if mum hadn't come back from work. Again, I'm not just being nostalgic, but there was a sense of the data. There were some horizontals across a couple of houses in my street. And my kids, we live in the village, North Queensferry, and there are some of those. But in the cities, the urban context, it's tricky to think about horizontals. I guess you've all got horizontals, but sometimes they're a car driver away, or they're out of the eyesight of the kids. So absolutely, wouldn't it be interesting to explore those geographies?
Those are questions. Carry on.
Oh, sorry. You're right. To the eyes.
So what happens when the routine changes, when someone goes to the job and decides that they can't take this path anymore? Do you recalculate what they do and then put that back into the system?
Yeah, again, we now have to talk hypothetically because these are all rigged kind of routines. But in theory, the database, so in the same way that Google now runs your routine, so it looks at your patterns over the past. If there's an anomaly and you're not present in that space and time, it can't use you. So it tries to build patterns across the familiar patterns, the likely, but if you're not there, then it can't send you a message, you're not in that. So it takes the GPS coordinates. So if your GPS coordinates are not in that anticipated.
I was quite tickled by the old boy, and I just want to be like that when I grow up. I think that's one of the issues that I was quite tickled by, is that people are going to not necessarily change and do things. I mean, one of the biggest problems we had in terms of trying to change people's habits was trying to convince people that they didn't actually have to spend millions of pounds on MasterMap. Because for 90% of what they needed, they only needed a cheaper aerial photograph.
Yeah.
But we've always had it, therefore that's what we must always do. So the question, I suppose, is there a kind of age or generational thing? So people like me are more likely to have that kind of philosophy, whereas folk in this room are more likely to say, okay, yeah, we'll change, you know, and if the machine is coming up with a better way of doing it, yeah, we'll do that. Whereas somebody like me might say, oh, wait a minute, no, yeah. That's a machine telling me.
No, really, I know better. I don't know yet. I mean, working with Ewan a little bit, they work with the Living Lab, in terms of dementia, working with the Edinburgh wants to be a dementia-friendly city, and there's a whole load of things that people don't want to lose from routines. So some of the things that I might be trying to critique, which are established routines, Betty wants to get on the bus at a certain time, get to the library to see her pals, get to have a coffee with Susie, and get home. As soon as there's friction in getting on the bus, Betty's really worried she'll be housebound because she loses the confidence. So I don't want to dispel this idea that for some of us, routines are really important. Social frameworks in order to have identity and knowledge and have an experience of the city. So the radical is trying to mix it up. And I think it's a balance. I suspect that a cultural, a society that has a balance of those things, if it becomes too programmatic, it then becomes limited. And I suppose I'm worried that humans can no longer see past some of these programmatic practices. So change and difference is very tricky. But having said that, in the workshop with a woman who handles dementia toilets, she said she was very up for... old people are quite happy with their smartphones. So we had an idea for dementia toilets. Rather than going to every toilet that is different, maybe every toilet interfaces to your phone. So I know that you might have a smartphone, and chances are your homepage looks different, oopsie-daisy, to mine. But in the end, you know how to make a phone call on it. So if I know how to flush the toilet, maybe what I do is I flush the toilet from here instead of trying to figure out the centralized. Does that make sense?
So yeah.
Where does familiarity have to be? Is it in software or is it in hardware? If it's in hardware, we all have to go to it. If it might be in software, it might be useful for some people to say, I want to flush the toilet now, or speak, flush. And the software takes the load. But I don't know, that's rather speculative about
it. Yeah, that makes sense.
Flexibility and open-mindedness, complicated ideas across generations. I've got to be somewhere else at six.
I was going to say, is that us? Was there another question?
I do work here, so you can take me out for a tea.
Yeah, we must do this again. I was going to say that does put a different take on the. I've not got a very good phone. I've not got a smartphone. But I complain of that. I think we're all running away a week. So, if that's the questions, just before we clap, remains to say thank you all for coming. Thank you to the volunteers for helping. And wow, so much to think about. I was going to ask, are we on set for 2017? But we will see. So I think with all that, much to think about. Thank you very much to Chris for a very interesting talk indeed.
Thanks very much.